Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the sixth in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas, and I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today's panel consists of Dave Musgrave, Michelle Church, Mark Masteller. What we're going to be talking about today is climate change. Now, before we go any further, I need to make a correction of a mistake I made in a previous discussion. The time we were talking about Trump, Warren Keogh brought up the point about something that was put together by Bill Kristol. And I said, yeah, Bill Kristol, the National Review. Well, Bill Kristol does not work for the National Review. He is editor-at-large at the Weekly Standard. I apologize for that mistake. Today we're going to be talking about climate change. And the first question I have for the panel is, global warming a legitimate phrase to describe what is happening here on our planet?
Well, I will say absolutely. We have a farm, and so I guess my expertise on this panel is just personal anecdotal evidence. In the 20 years that we've been here, we plant earlier. We plant more different kinds of varieties than we were able to plant before. There's way less snow cover. There's definitely a change in the climate.
So you have seen the warming of the climate. I was basically asking if warming is a legitimate way to describe it, because that seemed to have some political fallout, the idea of global warming. We actually had to change the phrase from global warming to climate change just to get everybody's attention.
Warming, this spring was very cool, and the soils were really cool. Later than normal. And so that is what people kind of glom onto and say that it's not warming. So to me, climate change is a more appropriate terminology.
Than global warming.
Yes. I guess my thought process is that personally I like global weirding, but if you look at the science...
No, wait a minute. You're going to have to explain what weirding means, global weirding.
Well, I'll get to that.
Okay.
But if you look at the science, what we talk about is surface temperatures increasing. And so I think that's the root or the origin of the idea of global warming, because in general, the globe is warming thanks to carbon and other greenhouse gases. But the result of that, which is the weirding part, is that we're seeing more extremes in both directions. Or if we're talking just temperature right now, we're seeing both extremes in both directions. Warmer warms, colder colds, more moisture, or more extreme moisture events, more extreme drought events. So I personally have kind of I prefer climate change. Global warming is certainly a portion of that. And when you look at surface temperatures based on what's been both documented and what's predicted, it's a warming trend. But there are these impacts that go both ways.
Okay, Dave, you what do you say about being from the ocean? I heard on the radio the other day a lot of the fishermen were talking about how the salmon don't know where to go now because of all the temperature change. Then you're an expert in the ocean aspect of it. Is it warming a legitimate way to describe this?
Yeah, well, let me just say my background was in physical oceanography. I was up at University of Alaska Fairbanks for 20 years as a professor in physical oceanography. So a lot of the research I did relate to climate change. And beyond just the temperature changes, either warming or cooling, there are many other effects such as winds, droughts, more rainfall in places. And climate change is probably better captures the totality of it. And remember that effects in one place will be completely different in other places. So it really is region dependent, and it might even be microclimate dependent. So, you know, it could change from acre to acre. That's a little far-fetched. But what's happening here in Alaska may be different than there may be an increase in temperature here in Alaska, and yet in other places, I can't point out one right now, but Australia, let's take an example. It's probably the greatest effect there is drought.
Yeah.
Instead of warming.
Yeah.
And there are, and just to speak to drought, there it appears that Alaska is in a drought, and it's been happening since the early 1900s, which some people suspect that the spruce bark beetle kill is due to a general drying in the south central region.
And then, you know, Paul, to your point of warming, the other thing we know is that the rate of warming is more rapid at the poles, so the higher latitudes. This is true both going north and south. But we're not only are we seeing this, measuring it in a place far north like Alaska compared to, say, the lower 48, but it's also projected to be worse and more rapid rate of change at higher latitudes. So we in Alaska stand to be hit a lot harder, and we're seeing that, and we also stand to get hit a lot harder as we go forward.
This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio, 89.7 on your radio dial in Palmer and Wasilla, 89.5 in the Sutton area, 91.5 at Glacier View. This is Bridging the Gap. Today we are Alaskans discussing climate change, one of the many issues that divides us politically. We are here to seek solutions to these issues through examination and dialogue. My next question, and I think we're all pretty qualified, except me, of course, to come up with an answer for this, is the scientific data comprehensive enough to allow for conclusions with enough importance to have an impact on policy decisions? Do we have enough data to affect the way we make policy? Dave, let's start with you.
Well, so when you talk about policy, there's always the issue of politics. So aside from that, it depends on...
No, that can be part of it.
Well, let me just start with the scientific part and what we have in the way of what people are looking at, scientists are looking at. And it depends on the issue you're looking at. So there is enough data for some things like global warming. There is enough, which it means an average... temperature of the Earth is increasing over time, and that's documented. So the issue becomes not really, well, besides the global warming in general, there's also the issue of is it man-made? Is it anthropogenic? Yeah. And that's a big issue, because if it's anthropogenic, that means you could have some effect on mitigating the global warming.
Okay, well, let me ask this then. Does the scientific data show that it is man-made?
Without a doubt. But, that's Mark, sorry.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to be careful. Some of the global warming is. I think it's this, if you look at some of the more careful scientific studies now, they're showing that since the Industrial Revolution, that maybe a half, maybe two-thirds can be ascribed to anthropogenic effects, and the rest is just... general climate warming, which can happen in any particular period.
The natural cycle.
Natural cycles, long-term cycles. I mean, there are natural cycles on top of this, too. I mean, we know about those. They happen on 5-year, 10-year cycles, 20-year cycles. But once you account for those, it appears most scientists have come, well, the people have done particular studies on how much to ascribe to anthropogenic effects, say it's somewhere between a half to two-thirds can be ascribed to man-made effects.
Okay, go ahead.
There's no doubt. And the way I like to describe this in my work, you know, teaching about energy efficiency and clean energy or renewable energy is We have about 800,000 years worth of data for carbon in the atmosphere. I always like to ask students or whoever is in the room, you know, how long have humans been around? Some people usually know that, but in our modern form, it's about 250,000 years. So we got 800,000 years worth of data of carbon in the atmosphere, and it's fluctuated between 200 parts per million and 300 parts per million. And in the last 300 years, it's now spiked to 400 parts per million and over. And we've never seen that in that last 800,000 years, when virtually everything that we know evolved. So there, to me, there's no doubt that the Industrial Revolution and how we learn to burn fossil fuels because we're smart has contributed then to that anthropogenic effect that Dave talks about. The second part of that is that if you look at the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, that's why they're doing the work. You know, we've got almost 30 years worth of reports now from that group, and they're meant to be policy neutral, but providing information to policymakers. And the reason they're providing all this huge amount of scientific information to these policymakers who want to listen anyway is because we can impact policy and make some changes.
Michelle, enough data for the policymakers to get off their duff and do something?
Well, I don't. I think for some policymakers, there will never be enough data. There's always enough counter data in order to make their case. I have a degree in natural science, but I can't even say anthropogenic.
Yes, you just did.
Okay. So there you go. So from sort of the layperson's standpoint, I think that in order to affect policy change, you have to be able to explain it in terms that that the layperson could understand. And to me, it's just sort of intuitive that like Mark was saying, since the Industrial Revolution, we have taken carbon that was in the ground in the form of coal and gas and oil, and we have put it into the atmosphere. So how the argument that that can't have an effect, to me, just falls flat just from a very non-scientific standpoint. So I think that to change policy, you have to be able to talk in a way that people can really relate to and go, oh, yeah, okay, I guess that does make sense. I mean, coal in the ground isn't going to affect the atmosphere, but when you burn it, then it certainly does. Humans have always burned wood. There have also always been natural-caused forest fires. There have always been volcanic activity and that sort of thing. So humans definitely, I mean, I really don't see how you can argue that we haven't had an effect. It's always this matter of how much, and we want everything to be black and white, and it's not black and white, and that's why policy gets all gummed up, because it's not black and white. And so we need to just look at things and make policy in terms of what makes sense. Sort of from a basic level.
And Paul, if I could follow up, Michelle said something earlier that I hear all the time now, which is interesting to me from this whole idea of human-induced. Even the other night in the hockey locker room, guys saying, back when we used to have winter, you know, Michelle described some impacts that she's seen. I've seen tremendous changes in my life, especially where I grew up, but I'm hearing it from lots of people now. You know, back when we had a winter, you know, this particular guy I'm thinking about lives in Willow, and he said, we just don't get those cold temperatures in Willow like we used to. But, you know, that's a relatively short view of things. This is why I like to trust the science and say, well, now they're taking that big view. I'm not a climate scientist, but I'm a scientist, and I know how to trust people who do science.
800,000 years is a lot more longitudinal than just Bingo. 7 or 8 years. Yeah. Okay. There has been some, just this past, I guess, 3 months, I guess we could say, some really tremendous weather events that have occurred And I'm talking about the hurricanes down in the lower 48, as well as the wildfires that occurred in California. Are we getting to the point now where the effect is becoming so egregious or so profound that we really need to, you know, I'm not saying panic, but get more results in our activity?
Yeah.
Yeah. You ready to panic?
No, but I think that, you know, again, this is how you get policy change. People don't get it, I guess, until it happens to them. And then you're able to make that argument a lot clearer. You know, I mean, look how many homes were lost in California in a very, you know, short period of time. Who knows? I don't think they've even determined what started that fire, but it's regardless of what started it. I mean, today it's triple digit figures in California in October. So I think now is the time for the scientists to be able to go out into the community and say, you know, very gently, we have to look at what is happening and why it's happening and how can we reduce this impact on you.
We're talking record devastation.
Right.
Pretty much record devastation. Do we need to be gentle there, Mark?
Well, I like to think about this as it's simply it's physics and chemistry. So as it was alluded to earlier, you know, when we take what I call carbon that's locked in Earth's crust and we put it into our atmosphere, our biosphere, you know, biospheric carbon is a certain amount. And now we're adding to it with carbon that was locked in Earth's crust. So it's just a matter of what are the physics and chemistry of what does that carbon do to our atmosphere and how it warms us up. That's just – it's like a window. You know, we know how to make windows hold heat or not hold heat, and that's what we're doing. We're kind of double glazing the planet. But now let's think about the physics and chemistry of why – and there was a good example of this on the radio the other day about how Hurricane Harvey – which is a weather event, was made worse by climate change. And it's pretty simple. When the water's warmer and the air's warmer, the air holds more water, and therefore it can deliver more water to the land when there's a storm. So now you have more severe rain. And then the other thing that I thought was pretty interesting that this climate scientist was talking about was the reason Hurricane Harvey seemed to stall and not move very fast. In other words, stay in one spot and dump a lot of water in one spot.
Houston.
Had to do with sea ice extent in the Arctic. And I thought, wow, there's that, you know, but think of how many people understand that connection between sea ice extent in the Arctic and a hurricane in the Gulf. But if you start to look at the global situation, that's the kind of connections we are seeing. And it goes right back to how do we then start to transition away from burning fossil fuels? You know, there's really a lot of value in fossil fuels, but burning them is really not the best thing we could be doing with them.
David Reese, go ahead.
If I can put a little cautionary note in here, though. As regards the science of climate change, there's a whole field now devoted to weather extreme events like droughts, hurricanes, tropical storms, things, winds, high winds, whether they're related to climate change or not. And this is, and you have to be very careful because sometimes the data supports it, sometimes it doesn't. And you have to have a long record of this stuff to say, and, you know, there are physics and chemistry that point to the fact that fossil fuel burning and increased CO2 may indeed create climate change, but to describe particular things like flooding during hurricanes, takes a careful statistical analysis. And for example, the hurricanes increase in frequency or strength have not been, so far as of a study I saw half a year ago, has not been related. I mean, you can make connections and hypotheses for it, but whether you can show that statistically is another, is very difficult to do.
And, well, and wouldn't Harvey, Irma, and Maria kind of skew that statistically just based on those three storms that occurred?
My guess is not.
Suggestion?
No, I guess it's not. I wouldn't think three events would be that. No. But there is an entity. I don't know if you're aware of it, Dave, but I heard about it on again on NPR. But it was some entity that is now working. You know, we have this issue of attribution of a weather event versus a climate event.
That's right. That's
and they're working specifically on this issue of attribution.
Yeah.
And my understanding of what they were saying is that we can attribute more and more of these things. But again, I go back
to not others.
Yeah. But I agree, because every weather event is different. But when we're starting to see more frequency and more severity of storms, that has been, at least according to the IPCC, you can see that in the data.
And wasn't that predicted, the frequency and severity?
Well, that's one thing the IPCC scientists did predict, is you will see these increases in severity and frequency.
So if I can just mention, when I was a graduate student going back in, what was it, it was like 80, 82 or so, and I was coming up for my physical ocean or chemical oceanography that time. That was just when Wally Broecker was starting to talk about the ocean conveyor belt and its relationship to climate, and how that general warming in the North Atlantic would shut down the conveyor belt, and which may cause catastrophic climate effects throughout the world. So that was just the beginning of my career in science, really. And I can remember back then, the question on my exams was what is global warming going to do for climate, and how is that going to affect the oceans and the atmosphere? And so that some of the things you're talking about, it has to do with, you warm things up at the equator, you eventually have to dump that heat at the poles. So you have to move all that heat that comes in at the equator, and it goes out at the poles. And the way you do that is you increase the amplitude of the jet stream. You know, the jet stream ambles back and forth.
Yeah.
And what global warming does is it makes that jet stream go farther north and farther south with time and in space.
So you get the polar vortex that we had a few years ago.
That's correct.
My family in Pennsylvania were very upset about that polar vortex, because we're having 40-degree temperatures up here in Alaska. They were down well below zero.
And as Wally Broecker said back then, he realized it was due to CO2 in the atmosphere, fossil fuels, and he warned then that we're performing an experiment that we don't know what the result is going to be.
All right.
By dumping CO2 into the atmosphere.
This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. This is Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing today climate change, one of the many issues that divides us politically. We're here to seek solutions to these issues through an examination and dialogue. Anything you'd like to comment on further on that particular issue there, Michelle?
Nope.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to the next question then. A recent poll published in April of 2017 indicated that a majority of the U.S. Senate and representatives are deniers of climate change. What does that tell you about the nature of our democracy?
I think there's money in denying climate change, is what that tells you.
And there's money in politics, and so you're
right.
Seeing that the
yes.
money, mm-hmm. that the denial is translating into the political coffers of
right.
those people mm-hmm. that are getting elected?
The special interest, you know, well, this to me, it goes back into the whole money in politics thing. I mean, the folks who have power in Washington, D.C. are ones who've traditionally had huge coffers of money. It's as simple as that. And you can see with entities like the Koch brothers spending millions of dollars to make sure certain people get elected, it has a direct effect on the attitude of the people in office.
You're an active guy there, Dave. What do you think about that?
I think Mark is exactly right. And you can point right to it. It's the Koch brothers and their ilk. They have amassed all kinds of funds and they've been doing this for a long time, and they figured out how to work the political system for years now with various institutes on college campuses that are under the guise of open research, but they're certainly not. They have an agenda. But I should say, so there is the issue of skewing of results from scientific research, mostly that. You know, it's very similar to what we saw during the tobacco industry and what they put in front of Congress then in terms of denial of the effects of, and they brought out all kinds of, people that purportedly had scientific expertise.
Credentials,
but they were paid directly by the tobacco industry, yeah. And they were puppets, baby. They were totally total shills, and we know this. Now we know this. At the time, we didn't. Well, that's what we're going through now. The various energy institutes, fossil fuel industry, as well as the Koch brothers, are paying scientists to basically deny climate change, and it's a total shill. But having said that, there's legitimate debate on not only the extent of anthropogenic effects on climate change, but also what the direction is going to be. Is the rate of climate change going to increase, decrease? And there's legitimate debate on that. And so when you get to, generally they say that something like 97% of scientists in the climate change field believe that anthropogenic effects are affecting climate change. And we can talk about where that study comes from because that's used all the time. That means that 3% don't believe that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean they're bad scientists. I know several scientists that I don't think are in the pockets of the energy industry. And they have legitimate concerns about the models that are being run to predict into the future what the effects of CO2 will be. So... But at some point, you do have to look at, the American Geophysical Union, who is the leader in geophysical research on the Earth, and what their climate scientists say and what their statements are, because they have, in some sense, there is a consensus within the scientific community. There are outliers, and there are legitimate reasons for, but... Yeah.
You can question the legitimacy of the models and the studies, but there's a preponderance of evidence there that 97% has caused these 97% of scientists to believe that climate change is man-made. So at some point you have to say, am I just spitting in the wind here, or is there really something happening?
Well, that's where I think it goes back to the question of the political divide that's going on in the country. If you look at America compared to European economies, they sort of, the arguments may be out there on how much human activity is causing this, but something is happening. And so they are taking sort of a more progressive view of that and saying, regardless of what's causing it, how can we use this or change our model in order to profit from it? So that's why they are moving more towards renewable energies and things like that. So there's money in that. Because there's money in that, there's political movement in that. In this country, there's enough doubt that's sprinkled around the whole political debate and everything. Everybody's on one side or the other. And so we have to really put it into terms where it's an economic benefit to the public to pressure their policy leaders to move towards something that's just, regardless of what's causing it, who cares? But let's figure out a way that we can, profit from it. Renewable energy sources would provide jobs for people in the coal country that, they're not going to get their jobs back because it's not economical to produce coal and use coal. So, whatever their political, promises and affiliations, it's just not going to happen. So, if we can make it profitable for those people to be retrained and retooled and everything to move towards, renewables, then that makes sense. America is way behind the eight ball when you look at the way the rest of the country is run. And to me, that's, I mean, as a farmer in Alaska, I see it as, regardless of the debate on who's causing what or whatever, the climate is warming. We have more opportunity in Alaska now to become a food producer. And because of the droughts and the floods and the whatever that's happening in our, you know, predominant lower 48 food belt, those problems are giving Alaska the opportunity to sort of, you know, in a
step up agriculture.
Right, exactly, because we can provide food now. So why would we not, why would our policymakers not be, you know, getting sucked down this rabbit hole of whether humans are causing this or not and just say, well, whatever's happening, we can do these things. We can do more of these things now that are going to benefit the economic standpoint of the public. And to me, that's where you're going to get a political change.
Well, when you first started talking about that, I was thinking, oh, she's giving me the perfect segue into my next question. But actually, you answered the next question. So I want to give these guys a chance to answer that same question. And that is, how do you answer the proponents of the notion that anti-pollution regulations by the government kills jobs and hurts the economy? And you, Michelle, you did a great job with that question, so I'm going to let Mark go ahead.
Oh,
how do you deal with that when people say, "Oh, we can't have all these regulations because we're going to lose jobs"?
So, basically, one of the things I like to point to is now the clean energy world in the United States is the fastest growing energy sector by far. Solar and wind have grown at least 20% per year for the past decade. There's now more people working in those sectors than there are in the entire fossil fuel industry. So that shows that it's there's a lot of opportunity out there. I also like to say that's not the same in Alaska, right? We're not there yet. And although we have seen a lot of growth in some of those industries, we're not growing the same way they are in the lower 48. But that doesn't mean we have a lot of potential. We don't have a lot of potential. And since our energy costs are a lot higher, we have a lot of incentive to go that way. So I think there's plenty of economic opportunity. And then just I'll end it by saying, 3 weeks ago or so, maybe four now, the CEO of Shell Corporation said, we are preparing for forever low oil prices. And he says they're retrenching and saying, we think oil prices are going to be low forever, and therefore we need to prepare for that. Well, we're seeing the results of hitching our wagon to a volatilely priced resource in Alaska. And we have to make the opportunities to go a different way in order to safeguard our own community economic health, in my view.
So the people that are relying on all that oil coming off the North Slope are just going to have to start rethinking.
Well, we're going to see a resizing. We are seeing a resizing of things right now. I mean, there's no doubt that the oil industry pays way better than anybody else. You won't see solar and wind jobs paying what the oil companies do, but you also don't see the volatility at this stage anyway in the job sector. But as a state, you know, we're seeing the problem. The recession is a result of being hitched to one thing that contributes a lot of money to your state treasury, and that's not a healthy situation going forward.
Dave, how do you answer that?
Well, I'd like to address fact that the federal government, as well as state governments, have always picked the winners and losers. It just so happened they've been picking the fossil fuel industry as the winners for a long time. And that, and you look at subsidies, the low royalties that they have to pay, it's an incredible subsidy, and it's perpetrated by the fact that there's a certain party in power right now, and they are financed by the Koch brothers and their compatriots. And that's not going to, it's very hard to change that. If the government decided to pick renewable energy, then there'd be new winners and new losers. So it's just a matter of, it's a trade-off between other losers and other winners. And I'm totally sympathetic to people in coal country that are losing their jobs. They have been losing their jobs for a long time, and they don't want to learn a new job. You know, it's easy to say, look, we're going to train you up to be in solar. Well, it's probably solar industry is probably not going to come to their location. They don't want to move. So something else has to be done. So I certainly understand their complaints that they're going to be on the losing side if we pick renewable energy. So like I guess.
But if I wanted to be a blacksmith all my life and there weren't any horses around, would you be sympathetic for me if I didn't do anything but be a blacksmith and
I'd certainly
no
understand that. Yeah, I would be. I would be very sympathetic. And that's what we're up against now. That's one of the reasons that we haven't been able to make a good argument to the whole country that we need to move in the direction of renewable energy, because we keep saying, well, screw you, buddy. You picked the wrong occupation. That's not acceptable. We got to look this straight in the face. And there are winners and losers.
So what do you say to the coal miner that the mine's closing down? You say to him, just hang in there, buddy. We're going to help you out here. Or?
Well, that's what we've been doing so far. Or we promise something that's not going to happen. That coal's going to come back, which it's not.
Is that a legitimate way to give
hope? There are actually some pretty interesting but local still models of solar coming to coal country, wind coming to coal country, et cetera. And what in my reading of some of this stuff, typically it's the younger folks who say, yeah, I'm willing to get new training, maybe work for less than the coal mine paid me, but I've got a job for a long time. And then typically, as we can imagine, older folks are not willing to make that change. But those changes are hard, but they're going to come because, as Michelle pointed out, you know, if you look at the world market for coal, that's what's driving what's happening to coal, or let's just say cheap natural gas is another big factor. So we can't just magically wave a wand and say the coal industry is coming back. It isn't going to happen.
This is Bridging the Gap on Radio Free Palmer. Today we're discussing climate change, one of the many issues that divides us politically. We're here to seek solutions through these issues, through examination and dialogue. On to the next question here. This goes to all of you. Do you have any reaction when President Trump pulled us out of the Paris Climate Accords? Was that your reaction?
Yes. Sort of that was my reaction. Oh, really? To me, that's refusing to be a part of the discussion at the table. Why would you walk away from that? From an economic standpoint, that was just really stupid.
It's for me, this is Mark, so Dave doesn't get attributed with this. It's another example of how we as a country are going to become a laughingstock of the world. It's a shame, but I believe now we have joined Nicaragua and Syria in pulling out. So that's classy company for the United States. And it's ridiculous. Again, as Michelle pointed out, the economic opportunities available if you start to embrace energy efficiency and clean energy are huge. And it's a reaction from somebody who simply doesn't understand, and a whole cadre of people in D.C. that would like to see it be the 1950s again.
Yeah, when I first, you know, when Trump was first elected, I was concerned that he might pull out of
he promised
Paris,
to.
Right.
Yeah.
But I knew he'd already promised it, but he started equivocating just beforehand, right? Tillerson was sending signals that we may not pull out, and so did Trump. And he pulled out, but he did say that, well, we still may abide by some parts of it. But it's, he kind of had to do that to play to his base. He really didn't have a choice in that sense. And we know that he's all over the place on a number of different issues, so it's really kind of hard to see, to put much faith in anything he says. But that I was very disappointed with that. And I hope that we'll see that something will be put in place besides that. But on the other hand, there is some a little bit of silver lining that we see local governments and state governments coming to the plate and saying, well, hell with the nation. We're going to go in this direction. I mean, California, which is
Jerry Brown. Yes.
Jerry Brown. They have the fifth largest economy in the world, and they've already committed to renewable energy.
They're actually making treaties with other nations.
Right. And that, Dave brings up a really good point, because now there's a little more, or you're at least local and state leaders are a little more prominent now, especially mayors. You're right. Seeing mayors across the nation who are feeling these impacts and having to pay for these impacts and whatnot. And they're saying, okay, it doesn't matter what the feds do. We know there's an issue. So to me, I agree. That's a silver lining to the whole thing.
Well, like in Florida, they have seawater already backing into their rain drains.
Sure.
So that's something that the local people are talking about a lot. If you have any personal anecdotes based on your own experience of climate change in Alaska, anything that you would like to share that happened to you or that you saw personally up here in Alaska?
Well, I don't know why I keep going first, because I'm like that.
Because we like you to go first.
There you go. So, awkward silences bother me. We've been farming for about 20 years or so on my husband's grandparents' colony farm. So we have anecdotal stories about the snowdrifts that used to come up over the top of the house and how they used to have to deal with that sort of thing in the wintertime. And now we don't have that. We don't have that kind of snow. We haven't had that kind of snow since we moved out here. We used to have enough snow that we would always dig sort of tunnels in the snow for our kids. That does not happen anymore. When we first started putting the farm back into production, you could not plant before Memorial Weekend. That was just sort of a rule. The soils were too cold. Nothing would germinate. So it was Memorial Weekend was when you would plant. And now we pretty much have everything in the ground by the middle of May.
Hmm.
That's across the board with farmers that I've seen everywhere. So
that's farming.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I moved, this is Mark, when I moved down from Fairbanks, so I've only been in the Matsu 27 years, so I can't comment beyond before that really, but... we had cool overcast summers. 65 was, kind of normal. And the winters were pretty mild as well, relative again to Fairbanks. And about 3 years ago, I think we had 2 weeks of 80 degrees. And again, I get a little leery about anecdotal stuff because mm-hmm. it is, these trends can happen.
Mm-hmm. So we're not being scientific at all about
well,
that
in
question.
One sense,
we're just being
but,
personal.
Yeah, in one sense, that's an issue. That's talking maybe about weather versus the bigger picture, and I really believe in that bigger picture. But the other thing is, I'm fortunate to have very old parents still, and I asked them, have you seen this? And my dad says there is no doubt. He started as a farmer in Iowa. We grew up in Colorado. When we were kids, we skated on our pond in the winter. Where they live, it's 70 degrees in January now. There is no ice. There never will be anymore. And so he's seeing it too, just like we talked about earlier, some of these anecdotal stories.
Well, the World Series today is opening in Los Angeles at 101 degrees.
Yep.
That's how they're playing the World Series. Okay, Dave, do you have anything? Or are you just going to stay strictly science, long-term longitudinal science studies?
No. I'm a big skier. Both in the valley, and I used to live in Fairbanks till about 2006. And the amount of snowfall that we've had for various reasons on the ground accumulated has really dropped off. So the skiing season is always marginal here. When I first came, so I've only been in the valley for about 10 years now. 2007, we were able to ski at the Mat River Park, the Crevasse Moraine and Alcantara. Those places are out now. I mean, for the most part, you may get lucky and ski there one day.
Yeah.
And even Government Peak now, its snow can be very iffy.
Hmm.
We're kind of lucky because we have the mountains close by, so the ski club grooms both Independence and Archangel, so we can ski up there. But there's very inconsistent snow even in the middle of winter now. And part of that is due to, for example, if you drive down Trunk Road now, a couple years ago, you drove down Trunk Road And in the middle of winter, there was no snow at all in the middle because it didn't, either there wasn't that much snow to begin with. When it came, it either melted or was blown away. It was gone. It was absent.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see, as much as you might try to plan for climate change, which we have to do, I think mitigation of climate change and reversing the effects by decreasing the amount of CO2 we dump in the atmosphere is also called for in the long run, because I think the cost of mitigation or of dealing with climate change is far going to outweigh what it costs now to decrease our CO2.
For a few coal miners and oil workers to their jobs to go in a different direction. Do we have the political will? Are you optimistic about having the political will to address these concerns? Or is it doom and gloom all the way?
Well, I guess I'll have to go back to the local level that I think the political will is growing at the local levels. Things go back and forth in D.C. and whatnot. So, but I would say that things can change rapidly, and I hope they will. But I'm not super optimistic right now. But I'm an optimist in general, thinking yes, we can do this. And sometimes we have to work locally and make it happen there, and then help that or have that affect others.
So organize politically on a local level.
Absolutely,
Michelle. Do we have the will?
Oh. Right now, I would say no. There isn't the political will, and again, I think it's because there's this intense divide in the country to where we won't even listen to each other, and so you can't make intelligent decisions when you're not even listening to each other. So something has to happen. You know, they always say with the hurricanes and people helping each other and how, yay, it brought us all together. And I think that that's kind of how human beings work, that, you know, things have to get really bad. And then once they get really bad, maybe we'll pull it together, or the leadership will see. And again, it goes back to money, to where, oh, I can make more money if I go with this renewable thing. And then they change sort of the presentation to the public, and the public goes along with it. I think that is what will have to happen. So I am optimistic, but I think it won't happen in my lifetime. But I think that things will get bad enough that my grandchildren's children will go, wow, really? You guys did this? And they will come up with a solution, because I do believe in the human intelligence and ingenuity.
We have progressed as a species in a lot of ways.
I'm not so quite so optimistic. I'm very pessimistic about it. I've seen this develop, like I say, since I was a graduate student in the early 80s. And I've seen very little political will to reverse the course of this. And even if you look at the administrations, if you get progressive versus a conservative, and they flop back and forth. But even under the progressive administrations, the progress on this has been very incremental.
Yeah.
And it's been, for the most part, if you see what's happened recently, everything that happened during the Obama administration has been reversed. One of the reasons is because he did it by executive action, and that can be reversed at any time.
But he couldn't get Congress to go along with it, why he had the executive action.
But I'm very pessimistic. I mean, for my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, I can only see it getting, especially in Alaska, which is what I'm really concerned about. Alaska is not going to be the same for them.
Yeah.
Permafrost is going to melt. And then you'll see a whole host of things. We've already seen changes here locally in South Central. We're seeing it up on, even more so up in the North Slope. It's disastrous.
And in
it's
oceans. Disastrous. In the ocean.
In the ocean. We've already seen acidification and changes in whole ecosystems. Who knows what will happen with the salmon in the future, which rely on ocean productivity and the smaller animals that live there, the euphausids and the krill and so forth.
Yeah, the fishermen.
Those are changing.
That the salmon are confused. That the temperature.
Well,
is.
And it's interesting because I think of salmon as kind of a place a lot of people can agree. You know, people seem to love salmon. Most people, maybe not to eat them, but I do. But anyway, when we asked candidates recently for the local and state elections about salmon habitat and protecting salmon habitat, which is something we can do in the Matsu Valley. You know, that's what we have control over. We don't have control over the open ocean. We got control over what's happening in the Matsu. And even then, there was some equivocating about, you know, because I think, you know, that water has to be cool for salmon, and a slight temperature change in that water means you don't have spawning salmon. That's a huge deal to me. And yet we still don't want to, you know, really take the bull by the horns and actually protect salmon habitat the way I think it could be protected with minimal effort, really.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. Today we're discussing climate change with Dave Musgrave, Michelle Church, and Mark Masteller. Has the ideological alignment of the two major parties on this issue had any effect on your politics?
Well, I can start. I don't identify as either of those parties. I've been frustrated with them for years, largely because of the role of money in politics. But the one thing that I've seen that is maybe positive in this aspect is that they're in Congress. There's this thing called the Citizens Caucus, or the Legislative Caucus for Climate, something like that, where the caucus forms by having one Republican and one Democrat join the caucus. You can't do it just one or the other. It has to be two at a time joining.
So you have to get a partner on the other side of the aisle.
Bingo. And okay. That caucus has been growing. It's slow. It's frustrating. There's other things we can do at other levels, but it's one.
How big is it now?
I think it's about 60 legislators now, but don't quote me on that. Okay. There's other people who know more than me.
What was the question again?
The question is, has the ideological alignment of the two major parties on this issue of climate change had any effect on your politics?
Well, like Mark, I also have never been a registered either party. But yes, I think the rigidity and the way that the Republican Party in particular have manipulated the discussion for political gain makes me a little more disgusted with them than I am with the Democrats.
So is it disgust, Dave, that you feel?
In general, yeah, I'm pretty pessimistic about the fact that the Republicans have denied climate change in general. They don't even, a lot of them purport not even to follow science at all. And, for example, we see this with the EPA right now, where they're kicking all the scientists out of EPA because they don't follow the party line.
Yeah.
That's just one example. But I was heartened to hear in front of the AFN conference that Senator Murkowski came out and said explicitly that there's climate change. We haven't seen that for Senator Sullivan or Congressman Young. And so I call upon them now to join Senator Murkowski and recognize that changes are happening in Alaska and to look at the science instead of hiding behind this act that we often hear, well, I'm not a scientist. Well, you don't have to be a scientist. You can listen to scientists. And you should be able to separate those who have a vested interest in espousing climate denial, who are funded by the fossil fuel industry, and they should be able to see through that instead of using that to support their position.
Yeah. Yeah.
And thank you, Senator Murkowski.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's about all the time we have for today. I want to thank our panel, Mark Masteller, Michelle Church, Dave Musgrave. This has been a very good discussion of some very qualified panels. So let's go and continue this out on the street. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
That's all for today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.